Okay, it's great to be back with everyone. It's always a pleasure to see people from all over the world. People, nice. I continue to look forward to this class week after week, and look forward to learning with you today. So today's topic will be continuing, of course, but independently, but continuing the themes I've been discussing throughout the session so far. With a focus today on the question of active euthanasia. That is to say, laws which allow proactive actions or interventions that allow a person to die rather quickly. And we'll see a little variations of this, but this is a general trend in many Western countries, different places of Europe, and certainly when it comes to Canada, as we'll see momentarily, in many states in the United States. If I'm not mistaken, there's no state in the USA that allows active euthanasia, but there are a number of states, including California, that allow physician-assisted suicide. Okay? So in the case of euthanasia, that's when someone is actually helping someone else die, actively die. And in the case of physician-assisted suicide, we're having a case in which the doctor or the healthcare professional facilitates, provides a syringe, right, medicine, whatever it might be, in order to allow someone to take their own life. And as we've done throughout the class, we're going to be focusing particularly on questions of how Jews might approach these issues when it comes to public policy. Okay, so here we are, and with a particular eye to the question of religious liberty, because as we're going to see, one of the big issues that comes up is how do Jews who work in hospitals, other places, deal with this issue if they think it goes against their ethical or religious conscience. Okay, now, just to highlight, I think we may have discussed this at one point, but I think it's a good time to highlight this as well. This is an essay by Michael Ullman in a book called Last Rites, Assisted Suicide and Youth in Asia Debate. Make it a little bigger here. And Ullman is trying to highlight the point, which I think is obvious, but needs to, you know, remind ourselves of it. He said, listen, medical technology has done something incredible, which has made the continuance of life well beyond what was considered natural in the past. The result is that many who yesterday might have been left to die because nothing could be done, they're able to enjoy lives relatively free of debilitating pain or illness. But the same medical technology that affects these miraculous cures and gives a hope to the afflicted can also sustain biological existence over many years for patients who are, will soon be clinically dead. So when medical technology can, so to speak, cheat death, critical decisions must be made about the most appropriate course of treatment. Contemporary medicine, in short, seems to be caught in the dilemma created by medical technology itself. In other words, we have this tremendously powerful technology, which we've developed in order to keep people alive and to heal people, and very successfully in many cases, but also, and sometimes, can just extend our biological existence without actually preserving a sense of quality of life. And this is a dilemma that's been created by our own technological prowess. Now, just get this to work here better. Now, the example that I want to focus on today has to do with the law in Canada, the law known as Medical Assistance in Dying, MAID. This is a major shift over just the past few years. Americans or others might not be aware of it. Today in Canada, the law is, as you'll see, that a person can receive medical assistance in dying, that either the means through euthanasia or through physician-assisted suicide. And the criteria is as follows. You only need to be 18 years or older, capacity to make healthcare decisions. You have to do informed consent. You have to be eligible for publicly funded healthcare, meaning more or less you're a Canadian citizen and only. And here's the key point. Who are we going to allow this for? So we're going to allow for those who are diagnosed with a grievous and irremediable medical condition, where a person must meet all the following criteria: serious and incurable disease or disability, advanced state, and experiencing enduring physical or psychological suffering that is intolerable to them and that cannot be relieved under conditions that they consider acceptable. Okay, now, what you'll notice if you read this law carefully is that it does not include the provision that there has to be a terminal prognosis. That is to say that a person's, right, terminal prognosis in the sense that a person is going to die in the, let's say, the next 6 months or 12 months. That is no longer the case. Originally, that was the case in the law, and the law was amended to say that that is no longer a requirement. Significantly, moreover, in the next 6 weeks, there's going to be an additional change in the Canadian law. Let's pull it back up again, where mental illness can be the sole underlying medical condition. Okay, so as of March 17th, just after Purim, if I'm not mistaken, it will no longer be required for you to have some form of medical condition that is, let's say, a disease of some form that we normally think of, like, you know, Lou Gehrig's disease, Alzheimer's, whatever it might be, but instead it could just be a state of mental illness, which is grievous and irremediable. Now, this is leading to all sorts of concern, because once you broaden it to mental health, the question goes, well, how does this get defined? And who's defining it? And there's been a lot of nervousness, I'd say, about how this law will be applied as it gets changed. But it's important to note that the changes that are going on in Canada are already quite significant. So let me just pull up here. These are the number of deaths you can see since the law was passed. This is by the district. Two in the middle is Quebec and Ontario, the largest. And you'll see that in 2021, 10,000 people died in Canada through MAID, mostly euthanasia. So 3.3% of all deaths in Canada today, right, this is already 2021, right, have occurred through medical assistance in dying. So this is not a tangential or small phenomenon anymore. And those numbers are expected to rise now that the criteria has been loosened. Okay, so this is a real phenomenon. And as we're going to see, it's going to create some very interesting public policy and religious liberty dilemmas. All right, so let's take a look at some of the sources here in halachic circles. And if you'll see, this is the pasuk that discusses and from where we learn, the original learn, where we learn out this notion that person should not kill others themselves or self-inflicted wounds. This is from the Shiva Mitzvos Bnei Noach. Or we learn out, excuse me, Shiva Mitzvos Bnei Noach in Parsha Noach. V'achadim chen l'nafshotechem edrosh, miyad kol chayad rashenu, miyad adam, miyad ish achiv, edrosh en nefesh ha'adam. And so the Gemara learns from here this notion of saying that one is liable not just for taking someone else's life, but for taking their own life. Okay? This is a significant statement, right, which relates much broader to terms of autonomy of our own bodies. Now, whenever I teach this, I think it's always important to note the following. In as much as we might have this, what seems like an absolute prohibition, not just of death by suicide, right, but self-inflicted harm and wounds, anyone is familiar with stories in Tanakh, or for that matter, anyone who's familiar with many stories in Chazal, right, particularly the stories that we read about or talk about on Tisha B'Av, is familiar with stories in which various Jewish figures, usually in times of war or some other scenario, definitely took their own lives. Okay, so the most obvious and famous example of this, which has the most significance for our purposes, relates to Shaul HaMelech. King Saul falls. Well, the actual, what exactly happens there is, this is sort of related to this dilemma, but either he has his sword keeper stab him, or he falls on his own sword at the end of his life, so that way he doesn't get taken captive by the Plishtim. And the Medrash is bothered by that exception or that case. And it said, well, this excludes, the term ach excludes Shaul HaMelech. Maybe also excludes Hanania, Mishael, and Azariah in the case of throwing themselves into the fire. So this Medrash seems to indicate that maybe there's some exception for Shaul, for King Saul. And there's a whole long tradition on this. We could spend the whole shiur on this. How Mefarshim understood what Shaul did. But I just want to show you an example of the why this was significant in the 12th century. You might recall from Tisha B'Av and other K times, we refer to the Crusades, during the First Crusades, and the horrible things that happened to Jews during the First Crusades. And one of the things we know from various historical records is that not only did Jews frequently accept martyrdom to be killed, but they would even kill themselves rather than being forcibly converted, and in some cases, kill their own children. Okay, so that way they wouldn't be taken captive. This isn't a big secret. We have a couple of keynote about this on Tisha B'Av, right? It's actually interesting. It's interesting in its own right why this wasn't like a hidden story. I think it's sort of reflective in many ways. And in the 12th century, the Balei Tosfot, the rabbinic leaders of the time, have a big debate about whether this was justified, taking their own lives. And the Balei Tosfot, you can see it in their commentary to the Torah on this pasuk, said the following, that some say, Im hu yareh shelo yuchal be'atzmo lamo b'nisayon, if a person fears, right, that they won't be able to withstand the test and they'll do avodah zarah, right, then it is mutar for themselves to kill themselves. And they cite the case of Shaul in order to, as a precedent. And if you look at the Balei Tosfot, say, no, that is a terrible precedent, right? And it's a terrible thing to say that this would be the case. And Hananya, Mishael, and Azariah, that was only because Kvar Nimsaru Lemitah, their death sentence was assured. It was for sure thing. And what about Shaul? Let's look at this. Shaul Shelo Bereshut Chachamim Asa. Shaul was a sinner. He didn't do it. Now, he did it, but he didn't do it right. Now, this is fascinating because I think what you see is that as soon as you start to entertain the idea of having exceptions to the rule and saying, well, maybe there'll be times you create exceptions, it opens the Pandora's box, right? It opens all sorts of questions about how you may or may not be able to distinguish between different cases. And so the Chachamim, there's this pushback of saying, maybe we have exceptions, but maybe they're not precedents. Meaning, even if we have historical cases, don't take this to be a precedent. And maybe, you know, besides Shaul, maybe the most famous story related to this is a story which we also talk about in Tisha B'Av, of Hananya ben Tradion, the martyrdom of the great sage. And this story here is actually quite interesting. What happens, you recall, the Romans wrap him up in a Sefer Torah and burn him, right? They're burning him. And pull up this story here, 1 second. And this is from Hanan ben Trajon. And you recall the students say to him, Af atap tach picha v'tchiles la'esh, right? Open up your mouth so that way the fire will consume you faster. And look what he says to them. Mutav she'etlenu mishen natna, v'al yichavel hu be'atzmo. It's better for a person to let the one who gave him life to take his life, i.e. God, but don't harm yourself. So this would seem to go very well with the motto that we've set up, which is that person should not, all right, hasten their own death. But the end of the story gets a little complicated, because at the end of the story, the Roman guard asks him, can I remove from you the wet sponges and can I increase the flames? And Rebbe Hanan ben Trayden says, yes, do it. It's actually interesting. I always wonder myself, did the students know that's what he asked them to do? Don't know. Interesting question. But in any case, if you take a look here, you'll see in the Maharshal and others try to downplay the potential significance of this. In other words, the case is acknowledged, but yet they say, Mutav shit leno misha not nuts, bear for God who gave to take, va'al yachbol be'atzmo. Okay, and a person should not. But, like he notes, aval bikesh lachem lekav mitato. But Rav Hanan ben Trayden, it's hard to escape the conclusion that he did ask, right, someone else to speed it up. So, I mean, it's interesting that that might create some form of precedent of having assistance in taking one's own life. And the commentators are bothered by this tremendously. Rav Moshe Feinstein has a long tshuva where he struggles with this issue. Says maybe it was a shat v'dchak, right? It's an exceptional case. And so on, right? The point I'm trying to get at, though, is that you have these stories which we're not really sure what to do with. And this is a general phenomenon we've seen already with these agadic stories, and the implications of them aren't entirely clear. It seems clear we take pain seriously, but it also seems clear that we don't like the idea of people taking their own lives in order to, right, alleviate that pain. And so Rav Hanani ben Trajon may or may not be a precedent for anything, right, in terms of that story. And again, like Shaul HaMelech, big disputes over what to do with that phenomenon. Okay, so, excuse me 1 second. Yeah. All right, any questions until now? Let me just hold up here a second. So, like,
yeah, I have a question. Are these... Yeah. The ones that you're bringing forth now seem to me to be more around kind of a death sentence or a political issue rather than a terminal illness issue.
Excellent. So one of the questions that comes up here, and this is true about many of the stories that we see, what's the key factor of why their suicide might have been justified? Whether it's Shaul or the 400 children that jump into the sea or others. Is it because of the political turmoil, right, of them being forced to do avodah zarah or something like that, which is one phenomenon, in which case that would be totally irrelevant to questions of euthanasia? Or might the factor really be that they did this because they were just suffering yisurim, pain? And that's why it might have been justified for them to do what they did. Hard to answer that question, because the stories indicate pain, but they also indicate, as you mentioned, this political and larger subtext that goes well beyond questions of individual pain, but relate to national glory and honor and themes like that. So and within the Balei Tosfo, the commentators as well, you see this tension also. And that has huge ramifications for our question, because if this is all about just a political scenario, that's a unique circumstance. But if it's the key factor there is the amount of pain, that changes the equation entirely. Okay? And it's precisely why that's so hard to know. How much can you really get from those stories in this respect? Okay, now here's going to come. Marcy, go ahead.
Yeah, it seems that Hananya ben Trayden was being killed. He was going to die. Whereas some of the euthanasia people have a hopeless future, and they may be in pain. But if the intervention weren't taken, maybe they'd live for weeks or months, or that's, I don't know if that's a difference.
You're raising the right question. How relevant is that? I mean, keep in mind, if you recall from last week, we saw the Gemara in Shabbat, which says that you can't hasten someone's death. They compare it to a flickering candle, right? We shouldn't touch the candle here. So it seems that even Rav Hanani ben Trajon might have violated that rule in this circumstance. But you could ask, right? Are these cases parallel or not? I mean, in the case of Rav Hanani ben Trajon, it seems like death is really imminent. And with modern medicine, it doesn't have to be that way at all. So once
and also,
again,
I think, didn't they put the wool cloths on him to prolong?
Right. So but remember,
he wasn't cutting himself with a dagger. He was just having them remove whatever.
Well, initially he removes, but he also had the guard increase the flames. So that seems to create a different type of problem. Right. So again, you're asking all the right questions. And you're sort of left with this, well, what are these paradigms? What are these precedents, if anything? The precedents for, or are they precedents for nothing? They're just, you know, moving, inspiring or tragic stories, but nothing more than that. Also a possibility. Right? Now, one thing to keep in mind though, despite this prohibition of hastening death or taking one's life, it is absolutely understood and agreed upon that pain has to be addressed. Okay. Now, what do I mean by that? So if you take a look, for example, in Israel's law for the terminally ill, I think I might mention this at one point, but Israel's law for the terminally ill is very much inspired by halakha. It was created after a 59-person committee came and agreed upon the terms of it, headed by Professor Avram Steinberg of Shari Tzedek, a very big Talmud Chacham. And in that law, it makes the following claim. It says, listen, pain relief, okay, with narcotic-based medicines, morphine, whatever it might be, sometimes, right, particularly when a person is very ill, can repress breathing. So when you give a person pain medication, that might come to hasten their death. Is that allowed? The answer is yes, absolutely. As long as it's being administered for the purpose of alleviating pain, not in order to hasten the patient's death, right? And this is a very, very important point. And they added also that it might be if you take care of someone's pain, they'll actually live longer because pain kills. Now, if you look at who he quotes here, it's Rabbi Eliezer Waldorf, but he's not the only one. But he was the posek for Shaarei Tzedek Hospital. And Rabbi Waldenberg was, we mentioned in the past, was very much a believer in general that every moment of life is of great value. But nonetheless, he said, you gotta treat the pain. Why? Because there's nothing more difficult for a person than great pain. When one gives a medication in order to lessen the pain, this is considered part of medical practice and is permitted even if it has the potential to shorten life. Okay, so Rabbi Waldenberg, amongst many others, saw pain in its own right as something which has to be addressed. Okay, so to give an example, let's say a person has cancer, Chalila, right, and they're also experiencing a lot of pain. So you could say, you may have thought, well, the problem is the cancer. The pain is just a mental thing, and we're not going to do anything about the pain if it's going to hasten a person's death. And Rabbi Waldenberg is saying, no, there's cancer and there's pain, and you got to address the pain. And if the fact that you're addressing the pain, right, also as a side consequence, right, might cause the person's death to happen a little bit faster, it's irrelevant. You still had to deal with the pain. Okay? Someone put in the chat that the Catholics call this the doctrine of double effect. That's correct. It's not totally clear that we have the doctrine of double effect. I don't want to get into this right now. But the doctrine of double effect basically means if your intent is very important. So if you intend to address the pain, and as a consequence, person something else happens as well, that might not be a problem, especially if you're not sure that the action is going to cause this. Sometimes pain medication can repress breathing. Many times it doesn't. Okay? This has the doctrine of double effect, has many implications. In war, for example, can you bomb a area which has combatants, but also has non-combatants around it? So the doctrine of double effect would say that, yes, you can, because your intent is to kill the combatants. The fact that non-combatants are also killed is a side effect, which it doesn't have to concern us. But that's complicated, because if you know that's also going to happen, you know for sure, right? So how can you really say that was your intent? Okay. This is a much larger issue, but it's very much related in this case. So Daria points out in the chat here, this can be used, that logic can be used to justify a lot of things. And you're right. It can be used to justify a lot of things, which is why it's a very nuanced situation. Let me give you another example of this. There's something called palliative sedation. Okay, palliative sedation, many times when people are in the ICU, so their pain is being addressed through morphine or some other medicine, and that might reduce their alertness, but the pain is being controlled. There's sometimes a person might not be in the ICU, and there's a tremendous amount of pain, and it's an intractable pain that they cannot deal with. So sometimes we'll give them a form of sedation, which will make them not alert, which will reduce the pain, of course, significantly. But it's basically, we understand that within 2-3 days, whatever it might be, they're going to pass away in the situation of sedation. Is that allowed according to halacha? Well, this is relatively new, but the answer seems to be yes. Because once again, the intent is to address the pain. And the sub-consequence of that, the side consequence of that, it might be death, it might not be, and that is something that we have to take into account, but we still have to deal with the pain. So all I'm trying to highlight here is that the line here is very thin. Now what makes MAID, medical assistance in dying, or let's say euthanasia, so drastic is that we're not talking here about at the very end of life, right? So you could have a case where a person, let's say, has Lou Gehrig's disease, chas v'shalom, right? Or they have, you know, some form of terminal cancer, and it could be 3, 4, 5, 6 months and well beyond, right? But they've determined that they want to be in control of their death. They want to be in control and not get to the point where they'll feel so much pain, right? They may have pain right now, but they don't want to get to that point at all, right? And so part of what either euthanasia or, for that matter, physician-assisted suicide does is it allows a person to feel in control that they won't get to that extreme point. It's actually interesting. In California and other places, there are many people who get the prescription for physician-assisted suicide but don't use it. And they ask him, why didn't you use it? They said, I wanted to make sure if I felt I needed it, I had it. Right? But they don't actually use it. Okay, so euthanasia or physician assisted suicide is very different from treating pain at the very end of life in that respect, because part of what it's about is to try to give people a sense of control and autonomy over what they're doing. Now, you might say, listen, this is just a good killing, right? A well-intentioned killing. Okay? Maybe that was never even included in the prohibition. And so it's interesting to see the Ktav Kabbalah, Rav Tzvi Mecklenburg, 19th century Germany, very interesting parish. I'm sorry, maybe it's been translated into English now, actually, but I didn't have access to it. And he, on this pasuk, points out the following. He says, there are two different types of killers. There's the evil killer, who's doing it for the sake of revenge, nekama, or because, you know, he wants to take something from you, he wants to mug you, whatever it might be. And then there's the beneficent killer. That is, say, the person who's doing it for you, who someone's doing it because the person might be in Tsar Gadol, and he prefers death over life. And he notes we have that idea as well in Tanakh, but he wants you to know that too is included in the prohibition, even if you're doing it with good intentions or beneficent intentions, put it that way. Okay? Which is so fascinating to me that already in the 19th century, someone was conscious of this phenomenon and basically saying, understand that we know this is an issue and we want to assert that this is a problem. And for much of history, certainly in the West, it was understood that such a practice would not be allowed. Now, what's drastically changed, of course, in other places around the world is this notion of saying that, is the notion of saying that we should have control over how we die, okay? And if you look at the Canadian case when it came up in the Supreme Court, this is in 2015, Carter v. Canada, and the argument there was, that was made was that this is a matter of liberty. The rights to liberty and security of the person, which deal with concerns about autonomy, right? Autonomy here and quality of life are also engaged. An individual's response to a grievous and irremediable medical condition is a matter critical to their dignity and autonomy. Right? So if you are saying that a person's liberty, dignity is tied to their autonomy, then the prohibition of not allowing euthanasia or physician-assisted suicide is denying people the right to make, in this situation, to make decisions concerning their bodily integrity and medical care. And by leaving them to endure intolerable suffering, it impinges on their security of the person. Okay? So this was the argument that was given to the Supreme Court of Canada in 2015. And the Supreme Court of Canada basically said, we agree with this line of reasoning. And that's what it told the legislature. You've got a year to create a law that will allow medical assistance in dying. And as we saw, right, it is now the cause of death in 3% of death of the deaths in Canada today. Now, this argument about autonomy, right, is not new. Certainly wasn't invented in Canada. And I want to show you a very interesting discussion that occurred already in the late 90s. When the case of physician-assisted suicide came to the Supreme Court based on, I think this is the case in Washington State, if I'm not mistaken. And six well-known philosophers, okay, very, very famous. These are like Hall of Famers. Okay, Ronald Dworkin, Thomas Nagel, Robert Nozick, John Rawls, Judy Thompson, and Thomas Scanlon wrote an amicus brief to the United States Supreme Court, which they later published, and I think it was called the New York Review of Books, if I'm not mistaken. And it's called Assisted Suicide. Oh, Assisted Suicide. Sorry. One second here. Assisted Suicide, the Philosopher's Brief. Okay. And it's very interesting to see the argument that they make. And it goes along the lines very similar to the Canadian Supreme Court ultimately ruled, which basically said that this is a matter of individual conscience and religious or ethical conviction. And the Constitution, the government of the United States, right, is not supposed to be impinging and imposing convictions on its citizens. And it said, you know where this comes from? If the notion of saying we're allowed to hasten our own death as a matter of liberty flows from the right of people to make their own decisions about matters involving the most intimate and personal choices of a person they may make in a lifetime, choices central to personal dignity and autonomy. Now, look at the last line. Where did the philosophers say this idea has been enshrined in constitutional discussions? Planned Parenthood v. Casey, famous 1992 case in the Supreme Court, which affirmed the ruling of Roe v. Wade. So it's really fascinating is that these philosophers are basically saying we allowed abortion because we believe in autonomy. Once you believe in autonomy, you've got to also allow people to die the way they want to do it, die. This is a choice that is central to personal dignity and autonomy. Okay. And now here's one of the problems, though, of course, is that, you know, who's going to do this? We'll get to them momentarily. And they basically said as follows. We already allow people to withdraw care. You allow people to remove the ventilator, to extubate. If you're going to allow people to say to the doctor, I want to be extubated, what is the difference? In fact, you could argue that physician-assisted suicide is just quicker and more humane. And so their argument, which goes back to something we discussed last week, though, is basically along the lines of saying, if you're going to allow them to get the end result they wanted by withdrawing care, not just by withholding care, but withdrawing care, why not allow them to do it as well by saying to the doctor, let's do this faster and get over quicker before the pain starts. Okay. So this was their argument, and it was upheld in many respects, right? That to allow physician-assisted suicide. Now, as you can imagine, many people were pushed back against this. Right? And this relates, of course, to the very delicate point, which you already started to see last week, of distinctions between withholding care and withdrawing care, and to the next stage hastening, right? Of actually actively hastening death of physician-assisted suicide. But part of their argument is if you don't accept the distinction, right, and say that withdrawing care is allowed, if you don't accept the distinction between withholding, withdrawing, but you allow people to remove, why then can't you get to the same end result? And so this became a big debate, and many philosophers pushed back on this. And one of them was a guy named George Fletcher. Fletcher is one of the important philosophers of criminal law. Remember, this relates very much to criminal law as well. And Fletcher basically said, when the courts allow people to doctors to withdraw care, he quotes the case of Karen Quinlan and others, death is a contingent consequence. Maybe it happens, maybe it doesn't. But when you're telling them to kill, right? So then you're transforming entirely what the medical purpose of medicine is. You are corrupting the medical mission to save life. Okay. And this is an idea that was adopted by many, including Professor Leon Cass. Leon Cass was soon afterwards became the head of President Bush's commission on bioethics. He's a philosopher. He's also an MD at University of Chicago. He's actually now the provost or something like that of Shalem College in Jerusalem. Leon's Zionist and a traditional Jew. And Cass made the following arguments. He said, let's just see this. He says, when you withdraw care, it's not the physician that's doing the killing. It's the underlying fatal illness becomes the true cause of death. Right? But in this case, right, when you are now going to start to say, once you say we can withdraw care, we can also directly kill, then you are now saying that the physician, that the illness is what's going to kill. And here's where he gets to the really important part. He says that once you do this, you will transform how we relate to the end of life. Because society, instead of trying to think about how to act, that should probably be humanely, right? In the presence of finitude and about thinking about being our presence, what will end up being in societies that we live in is the only question will be is, how do we get rid of people, particularly when it costs a lot of money to keep these people alive? So the medical profession will be transformed, and society as a whole will be transformed. Now, it's interesting is that he's coming from the political right, but people on the political left are also opposed to this because they felt that basically the most underprivileged would be the first ones who would be most easily treated in a way to let them die faster. Okay. And if you take a look, let me just pull this up. This was a big deal a couple months ago. So the AP had a big report in August 2022, which was discussing their documenting disturbing cases of when euthanasia didn't seem to be done in a voluntary manner, but was more involuntary, okay? Or is being offered to people when it is totally inappropriate. And this led to a whole slew of various articles and New York Times editorials and editorials in Canadian. There's an excellent series on CTV, I think it is, CTV, had like a 5-part series discussing. And now this is only heating up even more because once the law changes in mid-March, so once you allow mental health to be the only reason, you're going to have all sorts of issues coming up as well. This is important to realize this. This is not just a conservative, sort of Christian right versus Canada and elsewhere. We're also very concerned about the different phenomenon here. Let's take some questions before we see some more sources. Julaine.
I just want to share something that's haunted me the past 30 years. It was a dear friend of mine, Heather Bradshaw. She worked in geriatrics and extended care. Now, this was 30 years ago. Her concern was that she saw many people who were not even yet in palliative care wanting and asking for euthanasia because they wanted to control their deaths. And her word was control their deaths instead of thinking about the process of dying or actually, like my mom who's 96, who was actually looking forward to her death with the family around her. So when Heather's husband, Steve, developed cancer, which was terminal, he wanted to do the MAID program. This was just happened to 2 years ago. And Heather told him it wasn't time yet. And I thought that was really beautiful. It wasn't time yet. He wasn't in pain. He has had his family around him. And so he ended up doing the euthanasia. But it was at the very end because how his cancer was affecting his body. And I think I think you touched on that very well when you talked about control, people wanting this control aspect. Thank you.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt. I mean, that is one of the factors. I mean, what I say to people, I was talking to some palliative care doctors recently, and I said, listen, the medicine today of palliative care, it's also advanced a lot. So there's a tremendous amount. What is the need then for euthanasia? And the thing that people, they all said back to me is that people want a sense of control. And the question is whether that's, it's totally legitimate, of course. I understand why people don't want pain. The question is whether the human experience is being radically transformed in certain ways because of this notion of control and autonomy or not. There's someone in the comment section who's adding, that the disabled are very much opposed to euthanasia because of fear they would be considered expendable. Yes, this is a very, very, very big concern right now. And expendable also because they're weaker, they're more vulnerable, and they're more expensive, quote unquote, the bigger burden on the budgets. And there's no doubt that money is a factor here, right? That's in terms of how healthcare resources are being allocated. I'm very concerned about it. People have, of course, their own positions on it. I'm very concerned about what will happen, not just in Canada. I know that my colleagues, the rabbinic colleagues and people involved in the rabbinic medical world in England are super concerned about the trends there. France right now has a bill. I forget where it's staged right now is, but there's advanced discussions already about euthanasia laws in France, and it's going to impact. It's going to impact the cultures that we live in very significant ways. So, you know, this is something which I think should be on the radar for a lot of people one way or another. I'll tell you one of the things I'm most concerned about is that once you create a society where the medical system has sort of the default is, well, if you can't control the pain, let's just do euthanasia, is that all the advances that we have in palliative care in general and hospice care might not be provided because it's like, why are we spending this money, much money on keeping people alive, which is very costly in the last year. So that's going to transform healthcare as a whole. And this is a matter of concern. But leaving aside that question, there's already concerns in terms of how this impacts the ability for Jews or others who don't agree with this philosophy of autonomy, right, in terms of how they can practice medicine or healthcare. I can tell you that one of the very, I won't name who it is, but one of the very distinguished rabbis in Canada was telling me about 6-9 months ago that he feels that from doctors, from Jewish doctors and from Muslim doctors, as he put it, right, and is very committed, religious Jews and Muslims, young students are being discouraged from going into medicine because they're being told that the trend is going to make it difficult for you to practice in good conscience. Now, the law, the legislature in Canada is certainly sensitive to that issue. And so let's see how they try to address this issue. And this is really a fascinating question, which gets into the question of, well, what do you do if you don't agree, right, with this law or what's being provided, or this option? Okay, so let me pull this up. So in Canada, the law, I gave here for Ontario, but this applies to other places as well. A law allows for conscientious objection. Okay. And what this says is that, this is a reference to the law referring to that the College of Physicians and Surgeons, right, can dictate a certain policy that allows people to do what's known as effective referral. Meaning, let's say you're a doctor, you're a general practitioner, let's say, and someone says to you, I want euthanasia, or I want a physician suicide, and that goes against your ethics, you have to do what's known as effective referral. What does effective referral mean? The physician takes positive action to connect a patient with another physician, healthcare provider, or agency. The physician can take these steps themselves or assign someone to do it, as long as it gets done, meaning you got to refer someone to a different doctor who can get this done. And that physician has to be non-objecting, meaning you need to know, right, that this person that you're referring the person to will actually do what they want, right, provide them and doesn't have the same religious or conscience objection. And so this is why it's called effective referral, because you can't just refer to another person who won't do it. Right, you have to refer to a person who will do it, and you got to do so in a timely manner. If you don't do it, right, then you will be brought up into, it's not so much charges, but you'll be brought up to disciplinary action by the medical society, which ultimately can mean losing your license. Okay, so this is a serious issue because it means that if you're a GP, a general practitioner, internist, or some other, doesn't only have to be, in Canada today, and your patient says, I want, you know, medical assistance in dying, you have to refer them to someone if you want to continue practicing medicine. So this is a very interesting issue. Now, many of the Catholics don't have a huge amount of political clout, but, you know, in Canada, but they have some, or don't like this at all because they feel that religious conscience means being able to say, I have nothing to do with this whatsoever. Right? It's not trying to tell someone you can't do it. But you could argue that if you're going to preserve and protect the religious liberty of a physician who disagrees with a conscientious objection to it, then you have to be able to allow that doctor to say, I want nothing to do with this. I'm not interested in this conversation. You can find out, go to the internet and find out how to do this on your own. But that's not the law in Canada. Right? The law in Canada demands that there should be effective referral. Okay? Now, is effective referral permissible under halakha? Okay, now, let's go back to the first class, if you remember, where we discussed this issue. And it coming now together, right, this issue of the case of, remember, we had the case where the Christian wants to buy, this is the Christian, someone else wants to buy a religious artifact that they're using for Avodah Zarah. Are you allowed to sell it to them? And the Ramah, Moshe Isselis, says, you want to recall, says, yes. Why are you allowed to sell it to them? Because you're not doing Avodah Zarah, yourself a Jew. And you're not even facilitating it because that religious artifact could be purchased from someone else. And so this is just aiding and abetting, and aiding and abetting isn't a problem when it comes to helping a non-Jew. Now, take a step back, though, of course, because that only applies to non-Jews. This would be an issue for Jews. And moreover, the question becomes is, well, what's the story here with a doctor who's giving a referral? Is that just aiding and abetting, or is that facilitating? Right? What is this? So this is not the first time such an issue came up in halachic discourse, and particularly came up much more in the context of abortions. So obviously, sometimes abortions are permissible, or according to Jewish law, or it may even be obligatory, right? That's particularly when the mother's life is in danger. But there are times when it would seem pretty clear that, according to a very broad position, broad swath of poskim and others, abortions would sometimes be illicit. Well, can you be the doctor that performs an illicit abortion? So that clearly would be a problem. That'd be a sore for a doctor to do an abortion themselves, right? They're doing the act. So that if the abortion is illicit under halacha, that's an issue. That raises a lot of questions. But what about also the anesthesiologist? Can the anesthesiologist, right, do what they have to do? What about the ultrasound technician? The ultrasound technician is an interesting case because they're just, let's say, being asked to test for either positioning of the fetus, or maybe they're being asked to check for genetic, right, for anatomical defects or something along those lines. Is that a problem? So both Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach and Rav Eliashiv ruled that an ultrasound technician does not have to give up their job, but an anesthesiologist would have to give up their job. Because they're taking a direct part. It's true they're not actually doing the abortion themselves, but they're taking a direct part in the procedure. Interestingly enough, Rabbi Waldenberg, the Tzitzit Eliezer, said no, even the anesthesiologist does not have to give up their job, even though this might be regularly occurring, because he felt that, someone else would do it, meaning you're not actually doing any killing and someone else would do it. And B, we don't require people to give up their jobs, which is a very significant thing, right? To give up their parnassah, right? To give up their money, essentially, in order to not aid and abet someone doing something like this. Okay. So that's an interesting parallel. And then the question becomes, well, how will this apply in the modern Canadian situation? So the chief, one of the significant dayanim in Montreal, his last name is Weiss, and his brother is Rabbi Usher Weiss, who's one of the most important poskim in Jerusalem today. And Rabbi Usher Weiss was asked to address this issue, and he gave a tshuva along the lines of Rabbi Waldenberg, of effective referral, where he basically said, listen, if you're referring someone to someone else, and it would be available anyway, this is not a problem. Because A, right, for the first and foremost, they go on the internet, they can find someone to do it for them. And B, he's not really sure that you're actually taking part in the act. You're just giving them a phone number. I'm not sure this is even aiding and abetting. So that's a very significant ruling of Rav Asher Weiss in the Canadian situation. But like I said, it's really sort of like a technical issue here, meaning it's an important one in terms of helping people who disagree with this when it comes to working at hospitals. But the much larger question is, what is going on in the societies in which we live in? Whether you like it or not, right? There's a positive, but that's the much broader question which is at stake in our circumstance here. Right? Are we dealing here with a case of something which we all agree no one wants people to suffer? No one wants people to suffer. We've seen this multiple times where Halakha recognizes the fact that quality of life is important. The question is, what are we going to do about it, and what limits might we impose, not just because of what we want for the doctors, but also what we want the society as a whole in which we live. And this is the much more significant and broader question. And I have no doubt that this impacts Jews as well. I mean, I know of cases, of actual cases, of people who are very committed to halacha and lab ways, who lived in places in which physicians' suicide or euthanasia was allowed. And they say, I can't go on anymore. I won't do this anymore. And they utilize that, which I'm not judging them by any means, but by any means. I never judge someone out of their shoes. And I'm certainly, I understand that, what might lead someone to do that. I have much broader questions for the societies and where it's going right now. When we start having a situation where 3% of deaths in a civilized Western country are being done purposely at the hands of healthcare professionals. That just somehow is going to change the societies we live in, and certainly the medical societies we live in. Okay, take some questions. Dr. Katz.
Yeah, I think that we have to rethink a lot of this because in the past, this never was a problem. Mama died when she was in her 60s or 50s or even younger, full faculties, and cancer was not that common unless it was genetic. We're living in a very different era now of people living much longer with many more diseases. And we're being now confronted with this that we never before really had to tackle.
Yeah. So I mean, that's definitely true. And, my own, as you saw, may have seen from last week, my own take on this is that we should try to expand or broaden the category of what goes into what we call a withholding treatment, a foregoing treatment. That's very much where my mindset is right now, of trying to think, creatively and carefully about what types of treatments we should allow people. And partly out of respect of autonomy, partly out of respect of we don't want people to suffer, to forego. As particularly when they have a terminal illness, or even if it's not a terminal illness, but acute critical illness, which happens a lot, with people with some form of illness and there's frailty, or there's dementia, all those things, right? So foregoing treatment, I think, is an important category that we need to really consider how that could be expanded. But I'm concerned by a situation where we are having healthcare professionals actively hasten, not just hasten death, but cause someone to die intentionally. I'm concerned about it. I don't even think we're at the slippery slope anymore. I think if you start reading those articles about the concerns in Canada, which might be exceptions and abuses, whatever it might be, I think those are real concerns to have right now. If you call it a slippery slope, we're already down the slope in some ways. And that gets me concerned. But I want to be fully honest here. If you take the approach which I mentioned, which we should expand that, the category of treatments that we allow people to forego, you're not going to solve all the problems. But you're not. You're going to have people who you cannot solve that problem for them. Now, I have many palliative care doctors who say to me, we will figure out how to solve the pain, even if that means palliative sedation. That's what we'll do. So maybe they're right. I think we have to recognize we're not going to be able to solve everything in either direction. We're going to have to choose on which side we err on these, on this matter. That's my own instinct on it. But I agree with you, Dr. Katz, that we need to be thinking creatively on this, because these are old dilemmas that have very new manifestations. Zahav, I see Zahav, gold.
Okay, I have a question about certification. So you talked about, you know, whether an anesthesiologist or the ultrasound technician can do or not do the act. But are they allowed to upgrade their skills when it's specifically for these things? Because sometimes you need to be certified or recertified. So can, those who don't want to do it obviously won't try and be recertified if it's very narrow. But from a halakhic point of view, are they allowed to put themselves in a position where they can be called upon to do these acts?
It's a good question. I need to think about that a little bit more. I don't see Rabbi Weiss addressing it in his tshuva, which hasn't been published yet, by the way. It's out there, but hasn't been published yet. So it could be addressed as in the fuller one. I know that in the case of the anesthesiologist and abortion, this was one of the things that came up, where the question was, if you felt it was a problem to perform anesthesiology in an illicit abortion, right? An abortion that wasn't allowed on halacha. So could you train in those situations? And there, the Tzitzit of Yezer just felt like it just wasn't a problem. And others, Rav Nevinson and others, reacted very strongly to that and said, like, how can you enshrine yourself in the profession, right, in that manner? So I don't know. I don't have a good – I need to think that one over a little bit more. I haven't seen it addressed enough. That's an important question, because at some point, certain fields will become transformed profoundly to include certain services like this. If you email me, I'll see if I can look a little bit more and see what I can find on that. Thank you for the questions, Alf. I see there's a, my listener. Yeah, Moshe, I think Moshe Broner is putting a point in the chat, which I agree with, right? That there's times when you might just say we're going to forego treatment in certain cases. Other questions? Rivka Horowitz asks, can you tell us more about Amatai? So Amatai is the organization that I'm heading now. It used to be called the Halachic Organ Donor Society, but we're rebranding it and expanding it to deal with all end-of-life issues, not just organ donation. And part of what we're trying to do is help people navigate these types of difficult decisions, because the questions coming up today are very acute for ourselves, for our loved ones. And we want to be able to be there to help people and give guidance in real time, and also to educate about some of these issues, do a proper advanced proxies and other issues like this, and to also advocate in certain ways for certain halachic lines of thinking, including this question of expanding what we forego in terms of treatments. And we're working with a lot of poskima on this issue, because it's important. It's really, really important. And we see this day in and day out. People are addressing these questions, and I don't think the other organization is doing it. So that's where we're trying to fill that gap. Dalia Hakimi.
Yeah, I just wanted to know how professionals can reach out to Amatai. What do you do, outreach? How do people know that you're available to consult with?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I mean, our new website will be up and live in about 2-3 weeks. And but you can always reach me here. I'll put it here as well. I think I can put my email here. at brody@amatai.org. They have a live hotline on the phone and a WhatsApp chat and all sorts of ways. And that we have three audiences. We have the broader Jewish community, we have rabbis, and we have healthcare professionals. And for all of them, we hope to sort of tailor our educational programs. Faye, you had a question.
Yes, I had a question. Actually, the earlier question is just shared information. Unfortunately, I had to deal with this with my husband recently. And, and what we did, you know, but my husband and I decided, you know, we got in contact with our rabbi and we presented our situation and said, look, there's medication which is going to be given. He was in palliative care, but we got in contact when the idea of giving him medication would highly possible put him into cardiac arrest versus not taking the medication, you know, at that point and just allow him to, you know, the process to continue. So, you know, without intervening. And, so we were very lucky to have an Orthodox, doctor, and we consulted with the rabbi, and basically he said, don't be too aggressive. You know, at this point, he's terminally ill. Let the process continue, you know, his process evolve. And, we went by that. And in fact, he was fine. I mean, like eventually what happened, he was in hospital and he was discharged home. And, within 2 weeks, he passed away. But if we had taken, I really truly believe if we had intervened, his body at that time would not tolerate the medication and he would have gone into cardiac arrest. And we knew we could not intubate because had we intubated, then did other complications of withdrawal care we didn't want to get into. So it's like, it was very good to have a rabbi we could talk to say, what do we do? And at the same time, understanding the consequences of having medication, which is going to be short-lived, but pass and put him into that unfortunate situation.
Yeah, thank you for sharing. I'm sorry for the loss. You're absolutely right that having the right people to consult with is super important. And you're also absolutely right that many times trying to do aggressive interventions not only won't help people recover, but actually could speed up and hasten their passing. And sometimes we call this AND, and now allow natural death. Mm-hmm. Right? But it should be allowing it, but with proper palliative care measures. Palliative care measures can be pain medications, but it can also be providing spiritual support and emotional support, both for the patient and for their loved ones that are around them. It is super, super important. And it's a transforming experience in a lot of different ways, whether you're getting that right type of care and support or not. And care, I don't mean just medical care. I mean it in terms of the whole emotional, communal, and social, psychological envelope that surrounds people. So it is super, super important, and it's super important for people to think about what types of treatments they'd want or wouldn't want and who they can turn to advise. Do this in advance. It's only so much you can plan and do things in advance, but the more that you've thought this out a little bit, the better you're going to be. I mean, the worst is to have 2 a.m. and to have some acute crisis and have to figure out, who do I call now? I haven't thought about this before. And that, I mean, I had a case, you know, it was so sad. It was a tremendous, tremendous woman. I mean, tremendous woman. I'm changing some details here, right? But who had gone through a tremendous amount since her childhood of multiple surgeries, of illnesses, and who lived to her late, you know, 60s and raised 5 or 6 kids and, you know, tremendous. I mean, tremendous. And at the end, she had a cancer that finally, after so many years, they couldn't treat. And she went into cardiac arrest and they had never discussed whether they should do resuscitation, to do CPR. And now it's sort of wild that they had never discussed it because she'd been sick so many years. But part of, I think, her way of her resilience was always assuming I can get through this. But at some point, we can't. And so in the end, the way she died was having CPR done to her for the last 2 hours, which just couldn't have been comfortable. Let's put it that way. Right. And so, and they're anyway, I don't want to get more of the details, but so yes, it's super important. And I'm so happy for you that you had a resource to help you think that through beforehand as well. I'll leave it at that. Thank you for sharing that.
Do you think that it would help to have like a book of case studies or something that people could relate to? Because you were saying that there are some situations we just can't help.
Well,
and then there are others that you do see. So like at least you could classify a particular situation. This is one we've dealt with. We can help.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things we're trying to build up are sort of paradigmatic cases in which, you know, we sort of develop certain paradigms of when we'd intervene and when not intervene. And that the more education you get about this, the more aware you're going to be of some of the questions to ask and think about and to speak to your healthcare professional about. But you can't always predict, right, where things are going to go, of course. Sometimes you have a better sense. And so books can sometimes help, but I think these days people like videos more than books, for better or for worse. I mean, I'm looking at some of the beautiful libraries behind people here. See, Rivka Horowitz has a nice library here. Dr. Katz has a nice library. So some of us still like to read, but apparently some people these days like videos. And so we're working a lot on videos, on these short videos that we're trying to educate people about. One of the big questions we educate about is do not intubate if you never think you're going to be able to extubate, meaning there's no point in putting someone under a ventilator if we never think it's going to be a bridge to nowhere. So mm-hmm. we just created a video like that in Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in L.A.
This is the thing that kills me. This is the whole point of how the heck do you ask a physician to know at the moment of crisis, is this futile or not futile to put in the... I want to feel that I can put in intubate anybody with the hope that this will be the bridge. I'm not a Navi. How am I supposed to know whether this is going to work or not? It's the worst thing that we have had in halacha, I think, because we're telling people don't put in the intubate. Don't intubate because you can't take it out. Well, maybe he would have lived.
Oh, okay. So, yeah. So there, that I actually totally agree with also. There are some cases where people will find intubation to be just medically inappropriate. Meaning, even if the person will live, right? So the physician will say, what are you doing this for? There are other cases, though, and this I agree with you, that... sometimes people say, oh, I don't want to intubate because if I intubate, halacha won't allow me to extubate. But it could be the intubation will be a bridge to somewhere and maybe not full recovery, but to some form of meaningful living. And so that is, I think, a very important point where you don't want to get to the point where people feel like I'm not going to ever intubate because I'm afraid that halacha is going to get me stuck. And so that is one of the areas where I want to develop is this idea of maybe we can extubate under certain circumstances, even if it may cause someone to die, but we're not sure. Because extubation also is uncertain. I mean, this is, you know, since you're from Englewood, so I've been talking to Ken Prager a lot about this, yeah, as a pulmonologist, right? And there are many times when people feel like, extubation, people assume extubation, when you pull the plug, so to speak, people die right away. It's not always how it happens. And maybe that's allowed. Maybe halacha wouldn't have a problem with that because you're not putting out the candle like we spoke about last week. Mm-hmm. So I'm very interested in developing that line of thinking right now, precisely because of those issues. So, but the point you're both raising, though, is we're in a world of uncertainty. I mean, medicine is not, you know, it's not like we always, you said it well, we're not like a Navi. And it's even not even Navi, just sometimes your probabilities, it's instinct based on experience. Mm-hmm. So in a world of uncertainty, you have to make halachic decisions, you know, that aren't just decisions. And we don't want people to get stuck in both directions.
But I just wanted to say, I think there's a very big difference because you made a very big point here about quality of life. You can intubate somebody if they're still going to continue to have a quality of life. So, you know, somebody might have been a writer or in the middle of a book or a project and or he hasn't seen his children to the end and he still wants to spend some more time with his family. He hasn't put his whole will in order. He hasn't. There are life end issues that he needs to deal with that if they extended his life, if he intubated, he could finish him. There are other people who have their mind is gone. They're practically a vegetable. They have such severe dementia that they don't know that time is passing.
Right.
I think there's a very big difference between the two. It's one thing to intubate somebody who knows that he's alive.
Right. So every case in its own. But yes, I mean, I think we could probably think through in terms of this. But every case needs to be thought of. You know, every healthcare journey is its own unique experience. So, it's hard in terms of that a little bit. But I'm sympathetic to, you know, a little bit of that, and especially with advanced dementia. Yeah, I get where you're coming from. Okay, I'm happy to stay on. I'll stick around. Next week, we're moving on to the questions of organ donation. By the way, Canada also has now euthanasia organ donation. Right, so they'll allow people, when they do euthanasia, to say, I want to donate organs as well, which is sort of fascinating. But we're going to get to some of the 2 weeks we're going to be doing organ donation, one on the classic debate when it comes to brain death. And then the second week, we'll be dealing with some of the new dilemmas and new technologies of organ donation. Okay, looking forward to continuing the conversation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rabbi Brody. Thank you, everyone. Shavua Tov.
Shavua Tov.
Thank you, Rabbi Brody.
Thank you.